Hi, this is Josh Barrow. On Thursday, October 20th, KCRW is coming out of our basement studios for a civilized, yet provocative, Left, Right, and Center Live. Join us at the beautiful Ace Hotel Theater in downtown Los Angeles for a night of amusing and insightful commentary on this unique election season. I'll be joined by Kelly Goff, Gene Sperling, and Mona Charon as we dissect Trump versus Clinton, Democrat versus Republican, and fact versus fiction. Buy your tickets today at kcrw.com/LRCLive.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. What did you have for breakfast?
Me?
Yes, you.
Vegemite on toast, of course.
Oh, my God. How just
I'm not
reinforcing
even making that up.
Of a stereotype.
I'm not even making that up. I was like, I should say a boiled egg and avocado, but I didn't. I was on the way out.
That's Louis Tikaram, chef at EPLP in West Hollywood. He's answering the radio question we ask of all our guests to find out how they sound on the mic. Pavan Mahendra, what did you have for breakfast?
I had 2 cups of coffee and just a sliver of a toast that my son left for me.
A sliver?
I didn't leave him
Knuckle,
anything.
Knuckle, you just he's left him a sliver?
Me. He's mocking me. Yeah.
What did you have for breakfast?
I had a sausage, egg and cheese McMuffin minus the egg and extra crispy hash brown with a Diet Coke.
Just the Diet Coke.
And I just had a slice of that amazing cheese pizza you have on campus.
It's so, yeah, that was my breakfast.
It's so good.
I had a slice of pepperoni pizza from the student cafeteria right here.
Sorry.
10 minutes ago.
I don't know what to say.
We're in such a...
If I was your mother, I would just be tearing out my hair.
She's doing that right now.
I have pulled all my hair, though. That's how I lost it.
Okay, that's good. So, Nikki, tell me what you had for breakfast.
This morning for breakfast, I had an apricot turnover with a lavender crust that our pastry chef, Leslie, made for us.
That's very nice.
Yes.
Okay, David, tell me what you had for breakfast.
I had Daisy SL from Riverside. I'm a test plot. They're a secret test plot that nobody else has access to. And I know the best trees and the best side of the best trees. I had some Daisy SL to compare from Tony Thatcher of Ojai. Normally, when you ask me to talk, I just launch into something from, it was an Abyssinian maid. And on her dulcimer she played, singing of Mount Abora. Could I revive within me her symphony and song? To such a deep delight would win me that with music loud and long, I would build that dome in air, that sunny dome, those caves of ice, and all who heard should see them there, and all should cry, beware, beware, his flashing eyes, his floating hair. Weave a circle round him thrice, and close your eyes with holy dread.
You need to be a cartoon character.
For he on honeydew hath fed, and drunk the milk of paradise.
What a great poem. Okay, here.
That was for Abby. It was an Abyssinian maid. You see, what she doesn't necessarily realize is that I had a cat named Abby, recently died almost exactly a year ago, alas.
I'm sorry.
But we have a new one, the light of our lives, Mira, the miracle cat.
It's always good to have a replacement. Here we go.
Kale, what did you have for breakfast?
For breakfast, I had a big old bowl of red lentils that became mash because I forgot that they were on the stove last night. And I put a lot of salt on there and some soy sauce and served it over a bed of cracked rice.
Like you made broken rice?
Yeah.
Shit on purpose?
Yeah. I had a tiny hammer and I cracked every grain.
I don't believe you.
Every little grain.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, this is Evan. How are you?
Oh, we're quite
really good.
What did you have for breakfast, Lolis?
I had eggs and rice and bacon.
Oh, that sounds very good.
Well, you know, I now got a rice cooker, and so it, like, keeps the rice warm the whole time. So it's like you get up and there's rice left over. You don't want to go to waste, so.
Okay. Tell me what you had for breakfast.
This morning for breakfast, I had some Greek yogurt, some chia seeds, and a white peach.
That is an extremely well-balanced breakfast for a Los Angeles chef,
and
I just want to tell you.
And green tea, hot. And then I had a cold brew from Endorphin with just a little bit of milk.
What did you have for breakfast?
I had a piece of Ezekiel toast with almond butter and avocado.
How Los Angeles of you.
Very Los Angeles. Very.
That's sort of hilarious.
Yeah. That's kind of my thing right now. I don't know what it is. It's just, I remember, you know, so funny you said that. Someone sent me an email about some blog that they went, and they said, what did you have for breakfast today? And I told her, she was like, I think I have to try, I don't understand the almond butter, but I'm going to have to try that. It was with eggs, too. So it was like a scrambled eggs on almond butter. So, sorry. What you do is you take the toast, put the almond butter, then the scrambled eggs, and then the avocado. So it's just all this great, it's really, really amazing.
So you're using the almond butter like butter.
Exactly, exactly. And it's adding that kind of fat and substance to it.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
Okay, are we ready?
Yeah.
Okay, Georges, tell me what you had for breakfast.
What I had for breakfast?
Yeah.
Normally my breakfast, it's a very light breakfast. It's going to be coffee or pastry. Or I will probably have orange juice. This is my greatest of it all.
Excellent. Okay.
Sardines and a pretzel.
Cauliflower soup at the restaurant by the time I got there at 9 o'clock after drop-off, just to test it.
This is hilarious. I had sushi at 10 o'clock this morning for breakfast. I was shopping at the Japanese market, and they had just put it out, and I was like, it's not too early for sushi.
Torn off end of a piece of baguette with French butter and some jam. No ice cream today. I had it last night for dinner.
I skipped breakfast this morning. Isn't that terrible?
Not really.
You know, sometimes you just have to get out the door. And yesterday I made beautiful French toast with the kids. Three coffees. That's what I had for breakfast.
Yeah, I was, you can probably hear my stomach growling in a minute because I went to a salad bar and got this extremely good-looking but very kind of, what shall I call it, very bumpy salad. A bumpy, lumpy salad. Yeah, now that's not breakfast. That was lunch. Breakfast, I had my usual orange juice and diet Red Bull combination. Fantastic way to start the day, man.
My fatunta this morning was a sad fatunta.
Why?
Well, I was out of bread, so I had to use a Bay's English muffin. So then I put some sliced avocado, some salsa verde, and Oaxacan string cheese.
That is Pavan Arjun and Nakul Mahendro, Nikki Nakayama, David Karp, Aubrey and Kale Walsh, Lolis Eric Eli, Issa Fabro, Matt Bianconello, T. George Laguerre, Anya Fernald, Christine Moore, Frances Derby, Jessica Coslow, Curtis Stone, David Jackson, Jonathan Gold. And I had a homemade scone. We played that montage to get you in the mood for a breakfast show. Yep, it's a whole hour about breakfast, because it is, after all, the most important meal of the day. First, let's turn to a breakfast food that's changed a lot in the past century. That's in just a sec. Don't turn that dial.
Santa Monica-based public radio station KCRW relies on the support of its listeners. One way to help is by donating your old car, truck, boat, or motorcycle. We'll pick up the vehicle from anywhere in the country, put your old ride to good use, and take advantage of a great tax write-off. Visit kcrw.com/cars.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW.
A lot of families would go to the community mill on Saturdays and get their corn ground that they needed for the week and flour as well. My grandmother would talk about how they like to have biscuits for breakfast every morning, but a lot of times before Saturday, her mother would run out of flour, and then you would end up having cornbread for breakfast, and that would disappoint everyone because biscuits were a treat and a luxury unto themselves.
That's April McGregor, a baker who owns Farmer's Daughter Pickles and Preserves in North Carolina. She's also done a tremendous amount of research into how biscuits have changed in the last century. So if they've changed that much, April, Tell us what they were originally.
The biggest difference would be that they were smaller. It was a rare thing that you would have a big biscuits. Big biscuits really stood out. That's where the term cat head biscuits comes from. And that would designate when a biscuit was a really large biscuit, as in it was the size of a cat's head. You know, today, pretty much all biscuits are the size of a cat's head. So whenever you make a normal size biscuit, everyone calls that a small biscuit. You know, biscuits would have been made actually with what much more resembles a whole grain flour, like today what we would call a whole wheat flour. If you see a whole wheat biscuit, you know, people think, oh, that must be a health food biscuit or something. Originally, at least country people would have had, or, you know, these sort of subsistence farming communities would have had biscuits that looked a little more like a whole wheat biscuit. In order to get the really bright white flour, it was a real luxury that came from sifting over and over the bran out of the flour. In modern days, we have white biscuits coming from a chemical process.
If we were to have eaten a biscuit, let's say 100 years ago, would it have been as tall? Were the leavenings used to make them rise the same as what we use today?
There was a type of biscuit known as a beaten biscuit that really was a small, dense biscuit that was a real luxury food. That wouldn't have been the type of biscuit that you would find in a sustenance farming community or in a more agrarian yeoman farmer household. Those were plantation biscuits. That would have been, you know, more than 100 years ago. But at 100 years ago, you know, you would see a baking soda, a biscuit, a leavened biscuit like you would see today. But they weren't as tall as what we have today. A lot of times people would actually pat out biscuits as opposed to roll them out. Now, that said, biscuits are highly personal, so there is variability from household to household. There wasn't one biscuit, but a lot of times they would have been made even before you got the chemical leavening, like baking sodas or baking powders. You would have had a yeasted type biscuit where you save a little bit of the dough from the batch before, and that sort of through wild fermentation would have leavened the dough somewhat. But the very, very early biscuits, like the beaten biscuits, they were aristocratic food of the planter's class. You know, the recipes for beaten biscuits call for someone to spend an hour beating a little mound of dough with a hammer to create these air bubbles that then go on to leaven the dough.
Wow, I always wondered what the beating was for. I always thought it was to make them very low-rise and chewy.
Right, because they do seem that.
So we have flour, which wouldn't have been as white as it is now, and we have a leavening similar to now. Let's talk about the fat. I would imagine that it was always lard back in the day.
Yeah, lard was definitely the most common fat or shortening. You know, before Crisco and vegetable shortening, shortening just referred to lard. That was the type of fat that was widely available. So almost always you would see lard as the fat that was cut into biscuits. And that made biscuits also much easier to work with than butter. In modern times, the most common fat would be Crisco or some type of vegetable shortening. But butter is sort of what's happening in the artisan food or the more, you know, high quality sort of local food movement. You'll see a lot of butter as the fat. But lard is by far more traditional.
And you say that actually using butter to make biscuits in your mind isn't very, quote, authentic.
It's delicious. I love butter. But yeah, lard would be the authentic biscuit fat. The other thing, in addition to being authentic, is lard just makes a biscuit dough much more forgiving and workable than butter, which has a higher water content. These sort of biscuit bricks that people talk about, that happens predominantly when you're using butter as the fat.
And back in the day, or in limited circumstances, wouldn't butter be considered a luxury that you would want to save for putting on the biscuit rather than in the biscuit?
Absolutely. The old saying, take two and butter them while they're hot. Butter would be served at the table. Butter was, in the agrarian South, generally a luxury food. And when I'm talking about Southern traditions, I generally mean of a small farmer, family household, not a plantation kitchen that would have had much more access to ingredients and luxuries and things like that.
And labor.
And labor. That's probably the most important one would be labor.
Biscuits are primarily associated with breakfast now. Is that the meal at which they were most traditionally eaten?
Yes. In the South, through most of its history, flour in general was a luxury because corn was much easier to grow. So cornbread would be the most predominant Southern bread, the bread that you would have with lunch, the midday meal, which was called dinner, which we would now call lunch. You would usually have cornbread then and sometimes leftover cornbread for your supper, your nighttime meal.
And what would garnish the biscuit? Were they always eaten sweet?
No, definitely not. A lot of times you would have a gravy made from just the leavings or the drippings that were left in the skillet from frying ham or bacon or fatback or sausage. A lot of times it would just be gravy and biscuits. Or you might have a country ham or a fried piece of fatback, which is generally like an unsmoked bacon piece that would be kind of fried until it's crispy. Often you would have preserves on the table. So you might have a savory gravy biscuit, or you might have a biscuit with pear preserves, fig preserves, muscadine or scuppernong grape preserves, or sorghum syrup. You would often use that as sort of a topping for biscuits as well.
And then the act of how people actually ate them, were they often turned into little sandwiches and eaten out of hand?
Well, you certainly could do that. The biscuit, you know, was portable. You would often find, you know, hunters or maybe, you know, you could take a leftover biscuit in your pocket out to the fields or something if you needed a snack. But in general, biscuits would have been split open so that the softer middle would be exposed, and then you would pour gravy or sorghum. Usually the sorghum would have been whipped with some butter and then kind of drizzled over the top of the biscuit, and the same with preserves. Well, actually, I guess really old, they would call it sopping biscuits. So you would take a biscuit and actually sop it or dip it into gravy or like a sorghum syrup or preserves, not even using a fork, but onto a plate or a saucer, you would do that. Most of the last 100 years, it would have been split open and eaten in the same way, but with generally with a fork. Nowadays, biscuit sandwiches are pretty much, other than maybe on Sunday at brunch in a Southern style restaurant, biscuits are almost always eaten from fast food restaurants in the form of some type of meat stuffed biscuit.
One last question. Could you school us on sweet potato biscuits?
Yes, absolutely. So sweet potatoes, by which I mean the root vegetable that is generally bright orange flesh root, but is often called a yam because of its resemblance to the yams of Africa. And it was most likely became called that because slaves in the southern U.S., sweet potatoes would have reminded them of African yams. There's now a colloquial use of the word yam when referring to sweet potatoes. I have a lot of experience with sweet potatoes because I grew up in the self-proclaimed sweet potato capital of the world. My father and my brother both grow sweet potatoes. And I, as a teenager, worked in the sweet potato fields as a summer job, and lots of sweet potatoes. We have an annual sweet potato festival in my hometown. So we often eat sweet potato biscuits. For us, sweet potato biscuits are sort of a celebratory biscuit that you might have around the fall or winter holidays, Thanksgiving and Christmas. You'll often have sweet potato biscuits that pair particularly well with country ham. So we'll make little sweet potato cocktail biscuits.
Are they made with like roasted fresh sweet potatoes, or is it made from some kind of flour?
There are commercial processes, and around the world, a lot in Asia, you'll see sweet potato flours, and in Peru, you'll see sweet potato flour. In the United States, we generally just use cold, roasted, or mashed leftover sweet potatoes. It needs to be cold so that it doesn't melt your butter or your other cooking fat.
And what's the proportion, more or less, between the potato and the flour?
So it's usually about up to 20%, but really you could go higher. But it does add some moisture to your dough. So usually you'll see like a recipe that has around 5 cups of flour and 1 cup of cold roasted sweet potato. You can go higher than that. In general, I mix my cold roasted sweet potato with the cold buttermilk. So I'll cut back a little bit on the buttermilk because the sweet potato does add some moisture to the recipe.
Find a recipe for April McGregor's sweet potato biscuits on the Good Food blog. So many of the breakfast foods that we eat here in the U.S. are sweet, from donuts and pancakes with maple syrup to frosted flakes and chocolate croissant. At Orson Winston in downtown L.A., Chef Joseph Centeno is going the savory route.
So here we have the salted cucumber, and we have gooey duck. This is a mix of different pickles. We have baby beets and watermelon rind and radishes and shiitake mushrooms.
In his airy open kitchen, Centeno's showing me the components of a Japanese breakfast he's got on the menu.
Some sorrel, and then we have the eggs to coddle. And this is bonito that I brought back from Japan in my bonito box. You just gotta apply the right amount of pressure and try not to take your palm off.
Was your first experience with Japanese breakfast in a home or at a hotel?
It was in a hotel. One of the first places that we went to was Yakumo Saro. It's kind of in this out-of-the-way neighborhood in Tokyo. This was the second one that we had gone to, and the meal started off with iris leaf tea, which I had never had. So simple and so delicious. And then it was followed by pickles. There's a rice dish. There's usually some sort of seafood, vegetables. But it really changes from region to region and neighborhood to neighborhood and family to family, like all food does.
Of course, there'll be variation. But is there a standard template that seems to always appear in different forms?
Yes. So at least in all the breakfasts that we had, it was an egg component, some sort of like miso-based soup, a pickled vegetable, fish, and a rice dish.
When I was there, I was kind of blown away because we're used to like maybe choking down some oatmeal or toast with jam. Maybe we'll have eggs or whatever if we have more time. But the idea of eating like a meal, a full meal in the morning was really interesting and kind of daunting. But then I grew to love it. What made you want to bring it here?
I'm not a real breakfast person. I start my day and I'm off and running. But we were on vacation and just really experiencing the culture. And it is kind of a morning ritual, and it's little bites, and it is very light for the most part.
Why don't you describe some of the most memorable ones you had when you were there?
The Yakumo Saryo was really incredible. We were in Hoshinoya Rashiyama, and it was the first time that we had had a hot pot version. It was amazing, like the whole spread that came out. There was like fresh sardine. It was lightly cured in koji, grilled. Then there was this big hot pot set up with all of these regional vegetables and leaves and bitter greens. And then there was this incredible rice dish that was so simple with just some shaved bonito, which when we were at Tsukiji Market, I got some from Akiyama Shoten, which I was able to bring back for the restaurant at Orson Winston. Got a bonito box, and we were able to shave it fresh when we do our Japanese breakfast here.
How long have you been doing them? Did you just start?
The day that I came back, we ran it the next day. So it seemed like such a natural dish to put on the menu. It was a way to kind of experience all the flavors in season right now. And being that we are like Japanese and Italian inspired, I mean, it just kind of went hand in hand with being able to use vegetables and rice. Like, for example, our miso soup is kind of a take on minestrone, so it's kind of a minestrone broth. And for our egg dish, we'd go between doing either like a truffled omelet or a coddled egg with cream of wheat and bacon and a maple sherry cream. Right now, we're doing like abalone and gooey duck, a small salad. We do our chicories that we do like a light salting and then light pickle on. It comes on a tray and served in different dishes.
Do you do a rice porridge?
We do a rice porridge on the menu. We use Mori's rice, Mori Onodera, his satsuki rice. That's an ingredient that we've used since day one, since we opened. And basically cook it in the style of a risotto. It's an incredible rice, the chew, the flavor, and it's so versatile because he used it for sushi when he had his restaurant. Then it's kind of this hybrid of kind of a porridge and risotto, which just has an incredible chew.
Recently, the availability of really super high quality fish has seemed to grow. Do you dry some of your sardines, or do you buy some fish from Japan that you're using?
Yes, I worked with IMP for many years, and now we're with Lux, and we use aji, we use the blackthroat, saori. I mean, we use a lot of fish from Japan, and we're able to because Orson Winston is tasting menu. So, I mean, a lot of these fish are like, for like 1.5 pound fish, is like $50. So that's exciting to be able to use these ingredients that are so insanely incredible, but are also insanely expensive, and be able to give that to our diner to experience, because you don't really see those items on a lot of menus. Come in, have a glass of wine and our version of the Japanese breakfast, or share it.
So you just said have it with a glass of wine. So we're not having this at 10 in the morning.
You could. Except that we're not open. But
are you open for lunch here?
Yes.
Okay. So you can have it for lunch.
Yes.
Are people responding well?
I think everyone who's coming in and has had the Japanese breakfast, I think, is like really intrigued by it. It's an age-old tradition, but it's kind of like a bento box. It's like the first small plates, I guess.
Joseph Centeno's restaurants are Orson Winston, Barama, Baco Mercat, Ludlow, and PYT. See what his Japanese breakfast looks like on our website. It's guaranteed to make you hungry. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood. In the South, the biscuit cornbread debate is serious. Since we covered biscuits earlier in the show, we hear from the cornmeal camp next. That's in a minute when the show continues.
Listen to the Rhythm Planet podcast to explore music from all corners of the globe, Brazilian, European, African, and tropical Latin. Rhythm Planet is a state of mind. You can listen at kcrw.com/rhythmplanet or on KCRW's app.
Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. I love cornmeal. It's always welcome, often ingenious, super comforting, and a palate for a huge number of flavors, especially at breakfast. Chef John Currents of Oxford, Mississippi, puts cornmeal through the paces at his restaurant Big Bad Breakfast. Now he also has a cookbook of the same name. What was your earliest introduction to cornmeal? Do you remember?
Well, my grandmother or my great-grandmother, one of the two of them, used to make these sort of overtly sort of corny cornmeal cookies. So they were like a sugar cookie made with cornmeal. And then, of course, you know, all of our oysters and catfish that we ate were fried with cornmeal. And so those are probably my earliest memories, I guess.
Let's talk for a minute about using cornmeal as a frying medium. You make this double oyster hangtown fry.
Yes. And, you know, it's just what I grew up with. You know, I never really gave, you know, frying oysters a second thought. And, you know, people love our fried oysters. And to me, they're just sort of, you know, the way that, you know, my family's always eaten them. And so it's always a little bit of a curiosity to me that folks respond the way that they do. But we use we make a dredge for the second dredge that is about half cornmeal and half flour that we season up really well. But yeah, I love the Hangtown Fry, just, you know, because of its sort of super simplicity and, you know, what the dish itself suggests, at least, you know, from a fairy tale standpoint, is really interesting to me, in that it's, you know, it's nothing more than, you know, sort of scrambled eggs and, you know, bacon and fried oysters, you know, which at the time that it came about in the mid 1800s. You know, were things that on the West Coast were all very precious, you know, but today they're, you know, just all sort of standard ingredients that, you know, you just sort of have with breakfast.
And yet it still seems like such a celebratory meal.
It does. I mean, and I guess it's just because, you know, there are not a lot of people who really do go, wake up in the morning and go, man, you know, some fried oysters on some scrambled eggs would be fantastic today. But it does just work. In my mind, it's You know, you hit that with a shot of hot sauce, and you know it's no different than putting oysters on a Caesar salad.
You mentioned that you use the cornmeal in a second dredge. Is the first dredge simply flour?
The first dredge is simply seasoned flour, and you know, and that is to really just like sort of knock any moisture off of the outside of the oyster, so that you know when you drop it in the egg wash coats and holds, so that when you go back in the second dredge, you know, it picks up and coats the entire oyster.
I'm curious, do you use the same kind of cornmeal for all the dishes that you use it in? Or do you have a few different kinds, different finenesses?
Well, I mean, that depends. You know, if we're making tamales, you know, we'll use a much more finely ground cornmeal, you know, which is more like a corn flour, but not quite, you know, as fine as a corn flour. And depending on sort of what tamales we're doing, we'll determine whether we use a nixtamal processed corn, you know, or just sort of a straight ground heirloom corn. So I don't think there was a whole lot of wet processed corn in the Delta when tamales were being made. And so it's really only been in the last, you know, 7 or 8 years that we really began, you know, experimenting with traditional Mexican practice of handling, you know, a wet processed corn. So to answer your question, yes. It's a long way of saying, sure.
I really love, though, that crumbliness, the difference in texture of a more Delta tamale. It's so different from what we eat out here.
Yeah, exactly. And it's a really interesting story, at least as we believe that we've dug into it and done the archaeology to, you know, to determine that ultimately that migrant farmers working in the Delta sort of during Reconstruction brought tamales with them. And because they were such a shelf-stable thing that had sort of as much in the way of protein and carbohydrate available in them, you know, that they were a perfect sort of field food, so that when the migrant workers left, the local African-American population just sort of picked up on the tradition of making these things. And so it is this very weird pocket of a, you know, sort of a purloined foodway that exists in the Delta. And it's they're not really in any way, you know, truly Mexican. I think our Latin workers, you know, are sort of fascinated with how un-Latin the typical, you know, Delta tamales are.
And I noticed that the Colombian bread arepas found its way onto your menu. How did that happen?
That came by way of actually Argentina for me. I've spent a lot of time in Argentina in the last 20 years dealing with the dove pestilence that threatens their grain crop every year, and have eaten a lot of arepas, you know, while I was down in Argentina, and they just became something that I sort of fell in love with. And like tamales, I think it's interesting that, you know, from country to country in South America, there are different interpretations of this, you know, the same sort of food thing. And so Argentinian arepas are, you know, completely different than Colombian arepas. And so it's, you know, it's one of those things that I just, you know, I feel like it's easy to adopt and sort of interpret in whatever way that you want.
How do you make them and how do you serve them on the menu?
In the recipe that we make most frequently, we combine cornmeal and fresh corn and some fresh corn that we actually puree up a little bit. So there's, you know, arguably three different kinds of corn.
And do you stuff them or do they just end up on the side for people to sop up juices of something else they've ordered?
Well, it sort of depends what we're doing. And we'll serve them as sort of a base under braised meats. We'll use them as ostensibly like a knife and fork sandwich. You know, we use them for folks to grab and to sop with, like a, you know, just an Indian flatbread. It all sort of depends on what we're doing with them.
One of the recipes in your book that I found most surprising was actually the homemade frosted cornflakes.
Okay.
I don't think I'd ever heard of anybody making cornflakes before. Could you describe the difference in the texture?
Well, I think that, you know, anybody who has their heart set on, you know, a Kellogg's product is, you know, is not going to find these an acceptable substitute. And, you know, and I would have been profoundly offended by them as a child if my mother came out in her tie-dyed skirt and tried to serve them to us and pass them off as such. But I got fascinated with the idea of cereals just because I read an article about 5 or 6 years ago sort of about how awful the extrusion process is for food. And a lot of, you know, our cereals are made through such a process. And so I started thinking about what we could do to sort of achieve the same thing. and not sort of extract all of the nutrients, you know, from the food as we were making it. And so the cornflakes that we make are, you know, they're not quite as thin. I think they have a much more sort of robust corn flavor to them, particularly when we're using our local ground cornmeal to make them with. And so it's really, you know, it's about as different an animal as it could be while appearing very much the same way.
And of course, they're frosted.
Whenever possible.
I actually am intrigued by making those so that I can beat them up and use them as a pie crust.
I think that or crusting chicken with them for fried chicken.
Wow. Have you done that?
Yeah, I've crusted chicken with just about everything that you possibly can.
I like that. So in the cornbread versus biscuits debate, are you a cornbread man?
I have such a weakness for good biscuits, and I think it starts at my grandmother's breakfast table and then really takes on a new life when I got to college up in Virginia, because biscuits do not make up a huge part of breakfast in New Orleans. I mean, New Orleans is such a very strange place in that it's, although we're, you know, as deeply embedded in the South as we could be, New Orleanians don't consider ourselves Southerners per se. You know, we're just sort of New Orleanians, and I think we look at the rest of the world like that old New Yorker cover where the New Yorker's view of the world, where there's, you know, just New York, and then there's kind of everything else out there. And I kind of say all the time, like, I firmly believe that you could pick up New Orleans and place it back down intact anywhere, and as long as you didn't cut off our rum supply, we'd be perfectly happy wherever we were. So biscuits and the sort of typically Southern foodstuffs that we think of, you know, don't necessarily weave together. And so it wasn't really till I got to college and biscuits became a big breakfast food. And there were a couple restaurants where we would go study at that stayed open all night long. And you could get fried chicken biscuits and ham biscuits and sausage biscuits that, you know, I really just fell head over heels in love. And, you know, I don't lie. I was just in Florence, Alabama, where the closest Bojangles is. And there was one day while I was there that I went and had 3 fried chicken biscuits at Bojangles.
We don't think poorly of you. And I understand that you actually figured out that you've made over 500,000 of your pepper biscuits for breakfast.
I have in like the universal eye, and that would be all of the delightful, wonderful women and men who, you know, go in there and slave over those biscuits every day. But yeah, I think that's by my most conservative math that we've probably crossed that number.
Every year we host a yearly pie contest. So I have to ask you a question. Is it true that you wrote a recipe for chocolate chess pie on the wall of a farmhouse you were living in?
Yeah, it's true. And what's worse than that is it came from these wonderful Baptist church ladies in the town of Farmville, Virginia, that we absolutely harassed for this recipe. There was a little diner called Walker's that we used to eat lunch at, and it had about 6 seats at it. And they served this just insane chocolate chess pie. And Mrs. Walker was very sweet to me and my 2 roommates. And we would frequently sort of ask her what we had to do to get the recipe for that chocolate chess pie. And she was adept at completely changing the subject without you realizing that, you know, that was happening. And so sort of one boozy Friday afternoon, we had a late lunch and it had some drinks, and we hung out in our car in the parking lot until Mrs. Walker came out of the restaurant and then kind of cornered her and said, you know, we're going to get that chocolate chess pie recipe. And she sent us, she immediately sort of pointed down the street and was like, I don't make them, okay? You know, I'm sorry, I'm ashamed. You know, it's the church ladies at the Baptist church down the street. And so we immediately went running down there and they immediately surrendered this recipe to us, and it was written on the wall in the kitchen of the farmhouse we lived in, and we kept all the ingredients in stock so that any night that we came home and we were hungry at 2 in the morning, we could make chocolate chess pie. And we frequently sat around on the floor of the kitchen until the chocolate chess pie was about 3/4 of the way done, and then pulled it out and ate hot chocolate lava on the floor of the kitchen.
How old were you?
I was old enough to know better, but I mean, this is when I was, you know, 18, 19, or 20 years old.
Big Bad Breakfast is the name of Chef John Currence's restaurant and his new cookbook. Next, we continue our breakfast crawl to eat plates and plates and plates of tasty Cantonese food. Stay with us.
Subscribe to KCRW's Today's Top Tune download podcast to receive a free song of the day, and find Today's Top Tune on KCRW's iTunes page.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW.
You guys have a gold mine down there in the San Gabriel Valley and then in Old Chinatown. I think you have a better range of foods than we do up here in the Bay Area. It's getting better. We're getting more people from mainland China and from all over the place. But as far as Cantonese foods go and dim sum, I'd say you guys haven't beaten the shade.
That's Carolyn Phillips, the author of a new book called The Dim Sum Field Guide. I would love to start with the history of the dim sum. How far back does it go in China?
Well, it started about 1,000 years ago. The dim sum that we think of today as dim sum is actually Cantonese dim sum, and that centered around the capital city of Guangzhou in Guangdong province, and then settled down into Hong Kong, and then from there throughout the world. And that really took off maybe around 150 years ago during Guangzhou's tea house heyday. And then it really took off from there toward the beginning of the Republic, which was started in 1911.
And I understand that dim sum is a Cantonese pronunciation. What does it mean?
It means a snack. Dian xin is what it means in Mandarin. And some people say that means a little bit of heart or something like that. But actually, it refers to some little something to eat, a snack.
You've said the word tea house. So that leads me to believe that we should begin with the tea.
Yes.
Most of us just wait until they plunk something down in the center of the table. Should we order a particular kind of tea?
That's a very good question. You actually should. You should have in mind exactly what it is you want to drink before you sit down, because if the server is any good, they will ask you, what kind of tea do you want? And you can say, for example, a black tea or a jasmine tea, green tea, or pu'er or chrysanthemum, whatever sounds good to you.
And do some pair better than others, or is it just simply a personal choice?
It's really personal choice. I prefer pu'er mixed with chrysanthemum because pu'er is a compressed tea. It's a black tea that's very, very rich and highly tannic. And it's balanced with these chrysanthemum flowers from Hangzhou. So they have a more of a floral honey flavor to them. So you've got a nice range of colors. And then the tannin inside of the tea acts a little bit like red wine. So it clears the palate between bites.
Oh, that's interesting. And I've never thought of combining those two.
Yeah, it's a classic. But, you know, everybody has their favorites. My late father-in-law was a total fan of jasmine tea, and there was nothing that would ever take the place for him. It was just always jasmine tea. Oolong is wonderful, too. Oolong has a more of a floral flavor. And, you know, it's just really what's your personal favorite. It's like choosing a wine. You know, what really satisfies you and makes you happy. That's all that matters.
So speaking from personal experience, it's all too easy to overorder when you go out for dim sum. So what's your recommendation on how many per diner? Where should we begin, I guess? How many plates should we order to start?
Well, when I go out with friends and for dim sum, I really recommend you have at least 4 people and up to a whole table of 10. Just to start with maybe 2 or 3 baskets, and that's it. And order from the kitchen. The Chinese have a term for it. It's called jizheng, which means steamed to order. And what that means is when the order comes into the kitchen, they then make it and steam it. So the texture of the wrapper is nice. The filling never falls out or becomes gummy. And order small amounts. You can always order more. But if they put everything on the table at once, you get kind of overwhelmed. The food gets cold and it's unappetizing. But if you have just a bite or two apiece, and then you get to talk and chit-chat with your friends and relax over a cup of tea, dim sum becomes this wonderful experience. It's much more than just having lunch. It's really more of a relaxation and aesthetic experience.
What is the etiquette? For example, when are you allowed to grab the last one?
Yeah, that's a very important one. You should always offer. It's like at your mother's table, you know, you offer everybody the last piece. And if you want to be the old maid, you can be the old maid, right? And then order more if you're still hungry.
Is that the deal? The person who takes the last piece will be an old maid?
No, that's just in my house. I was raised by a mother who was afraid I would never get married.
That's so funny. Is there any other kind of etiquette? Maybe how we use our implements?
Oh, gosh, there's a whole school of manners built up around eating in China. Basically, it's like here in the West, you know, you eat with your mouth closed, you're polite, you serve other people's first. But in China, it's if you're using chopsticks, you should hold them up toward the top, not toward the bottom, which gives you a more elegant look. It looks like you have more of a sophistication. And then when you're eating, try to make sure that there's no food on the chopsticks when you remove them from your mouth. If you have bones in your mouth or, for example, shrimp shells, just remove them with the chopsticks and put them on your plate. And then never stick your chopsticks inside of rice or a bowl or anything, because that's what they do in temples or in ceremonies to summon an ancestors or the dearly departed, is you put two sticks of incense inside of a bowl of rice. So it's kind of scary to Chinese people, and they get the willies.
Do we place our orders in a particular order? Like, do we start with steamed and then go to fried?
My suggestion is exactly that. Yeah, you start with something light, for example, hargal, which are the tiny shrimp steamed dumplings. Maybe something else that's lightly steamed, a vegetarian or crab or beef, but slightly light. And then slowly work your way up toward the deep fried things and then the breads. Because if you have, for example, a baked char siu bao at the beginning, the Chinese roast pork wrapped inside of the bread and baked, that might fill you up. Or the steamed buns, those will also fill you up very quickly, and you don't want that. You want to go slowly, have the small bites first, and then as you get more and more full, then you can bring out the heavier guns to really get full. And also, you can have the servers slice things in half. They'll usually have a pair of scissors on them somewhere, and they're dedicated for food, and they just will slit them in half, and then you can share. And that makes the bite smaller and gives you a chance to enjoy a much bigger range of foods.
I like that idea, although I don't know if the people I tend to go out with would approve.
I just tell my friends that this way you get a bigger range of dessert, right? We get to order like five or six desserts instead of two or three, and then they suddenly go, ooh, this is an excellent idea.
So what are some of the recommendations you have if we're more adventurous?
Well, I would say that every time you go out to eat, try something different. It's a chance and an opportunity to try a different culture and to see food through another people's eyes. For example, chicken feet. I have some friends that will not touch it with a 10-foot pole. And, you know, as much as I try to explain it to them that it's really incredible, they go, no, it just squicks them out. And so I don't force the issue. But if you can bring yourself to at least try them, just nibble on a toe, you'll find that it's really quite good. And then you can work your way up into the more interesting things, like, for example, goose intestines, which are actually like pieces of silk. The Chinese are like the world's greatest nose-to-tail eaters completely. In fact, they prefer the innards and the extremities. They think that those are the things that have the best textures and the best flavors.
You mentioned braised duck chins.
Mm.
I don't think I've ever had braised duck chin.
Well, I'm going to have to take you out for those, because those are incredible. It's the bottom half of the duck's head, so you're not having the brain. It's just the bottom bill. And what that really is it encapsulates the tongue. And so you have this bone going around the edge, which is the bottom part of the beak. And it holds the tongue, which is a very chewy piece of meat. And it's delicious. It has this wonderful texture. And they braise it in a soy sauce and rock sugar and wine. And then if they're really doing a good job, what they'll then do is roll it in some sort of a batter, deep fry it, and then toss it in a light sweet and sour sauce. As you bite down into it, you go through the sweet and sour, down to the batter, down to the braised flavors, down to the meat. And it's all these flavors and textures going on. It went into your mouth. It's just amazing.
Wow, all the layers of flavor.
One of the things that blows me away about Chinese food is it's not only flavor, but it's texture. Chinese actually go nuts for texture, and they're textures that we really don't have in the West. For example, in the West, we love things that are crispy, like everything is extra crispy, or potato chips, or French fries, or fried chicken, or something like that. But in China, what they really like are chewy things and gummy things. They make your mouth really go to work. Like a mochi, if you eat mochi, that's the beginning of the feeling of the flavor there and the texture.
So, of course, we have to end with a bite of something sweet. And I love that you said we could have four or five of them. So what would those be?
Well, it all depends upon the tea house. Every tea house has its specialties. So do your research. And what I do is, if I'm going to a tea house for the first time, in addition to looking at Yelp and asking my friends, I'll go in and I'll look at what all the Chinese people are eating. Because if they are a happy table of people and there are older people there that look like they come there often, they probably know what's best. They might have some custard tarts that are wonderful and flaky and just fresh out of the oven, or there might be these sesame roll-ups, just a very thin layer of rice flour cooked with sesame and sugar and rolled up into these thin sheets. And they look like rolls of film, which is what they call them in Cantonese. And, oh gosh, they've got jellies, they've got steamed buns. I could go on and on. Things made with tapioca. It all depends upon the place. They all have their specialties, and the thing is you have to find out what their specialties are, because no two places are alike if they're any good. They should have really good chefs in the back that specialize in this handful of foods that are just out of this world.
Carolyn Phillips is the author of the Dim Sum Field Guide. Obviously, we could talk about breakfast forever, but since we're running out of time, we close out the show with a food that's arguably more essential to breakfast than any other. Here's Miles Thompson, chef at Michael's in Santa Monica.
Food in general would not be the same without eggs. It's like the glue that holds together all the crazy ideas inside of cooks and chefs' heads.
Yep, we're talking about eggs.
We do use an incredible amount of eggs at the restaurant. We make all of our own pastas and aiolis and everything egg.
Laura Avery met Miles at the Santa Monica Farmers Market.
Okay, and when we buy eggs at the farmers market, we're getting the eggs that are free-range, hormone, antibiotic-free. They also come to the market not refrigerated. They're fresh out of the nest. How do you deal with that at the restaurant?
Well, there's a few ways we deal with it at the restaurant. One thing that we do is we age some of the eggs because we soft-boil them and we want to peel them. When you age the eggs, we put them in the wine room because it's not as cold as a refrigerator. So we can hold them for a shorter amount of time and they'll age a little faster, and then they're not like out at room temperature, which is actually fine. Peter Schiener told me that you can leave eggs out if they've never been refrigerated for 5 weeks before they need to be refrigerated, which is amazing. But once they're refrigerated, you have to keep them refrigerated. So that's an interesting tidbit. And then we just process them as you would normally use them.
So aging is just a matter of the longer the egg is out of the chicken, the easier it is to peel?
Yes, basically the way that I understand it is there's that thin membrane beneath the skin. And over time, that membrane will separate from the albumin, from the white protein in the egg. So when you boil the egg, you know, sometimes it's really hard to get the shell off. And particularly when you soft boil an egg, because the proteins are contracting less because they're not cooking as much, there's more tendency for them to stick to the outside. So by aging the egg, it naturally evaporates through the pores in the shell of the egg, so it shrinks away a little bit. And then you can peel the egg a little more easily and you get that perfect shape.
Who taught you about aging eggs?
Well, Harold McGee, I learned through his wonderful text about eggs and aging. And, you know, when you get eggs from the grocery store, if you ever buy like the scary white crazy eggs from the grocery store and you make a hard-boiled egg, they peel like incredibly rapidly because those eggs are aged for a long time. But when you get them from the farmer's market, it's very frustrating when you try to peel the eggs because they're so fresh, which is a good thing.
And you use a lot of eggs. You say you make aioli, you make pasta, you do the poached egg on the dish. So you use them throughout the menu, everything from appetizers, I assume, all the way through desserts.
Absolutely. We use them in everything on the menu. One of the things that really is kind of our egg dish is a little bit of a different play on an egg dish. It's not like just a fried egg on a plate we do have a deep fried soft boiled egg, but the one that I'm most excited about that is to feature these beautiful eggs is a rock crab custard. So we get these local rock crabs from Santa Barbara. They're caught by a woman named Stephanie, and she brings them to the restaurant alive. It's really amazing. And then we steam them and use the shells to make a broth that we then thicken with eggs and steam, and then serve it with a little bit of local sea urchin and rock crab meat.
Oh, and so now we're almost close to my favorite thing in the world is custard. Do you do a custard dish?
We do. We have two custard dishes. One is set with gelatin, which is a panna cotta, and then we have a pot de creme, which is baked and set. And then we actually scramble it and put it into an ISI, so a whipped cream canister. So it basically is a custard with the texture of whipped cream.
Oh, okay, so the whole range of what you can do with eggs. And how many dozen eggs do you go through a week, do you think?
Currently, we're going through two full cases of the eggs. And so that would be 30 dozen.
A week?
A week.
All right, so the restaurant's been open now about a couple of weeks?
Restaurant reopened on the 15th of September.
Oh, that's really exciting. And lunch and dinner?
Dinner only, currently.
Okay. All right. Well, Miles, it's so great to see you here, and I love that you can just walk back and forth anytime you want from the restaurant, and happy to see you here at the market again.
Thank you for having me.
That was Miles Thompson. He's the brand new executive chef at Michael's, which is celebrating its 37th year in Santa Monica at the same location. I think it set a record. We're talking now with Peter Schiener, who's the farmer Miles buys a lot of his, I guess, most of his eggs from. Peter's a farmer down in Valley Center. You've been raising eggs for a long time. You've got all different, you're the one with the emu eggs and the quail and the pheasant and the turkey and the duck and the chicken. But let's talk about your chickens. To supply Miles with 30 dozen eggs a week and everybody else, how many chickens do you have?
We have about 400 to 500, and some are resting so that they'll be laying eggs in the wintertime, and just try and keep them happy, and then they lay out good eggs.
And how do you rest them? You put them in a dark place?
No, we could either cut their feed back, take the protein out of their feed, maybe take them off water for half a day. It just shocks their system, and then it puts them into a molt where they will rest till they want to start up again, maybe 2 months later.
And doesn't molting mean the feathers fall out?
That's when they lose their feathers, yes. They'll lose their feathers, and then they grow new feathers again, and they come back basically a new chicken. They look prettier and lay better eggs.
And how many eggs a day does a healthy chicken lay?
About an egg a day.
Okay, and so your flock of 500, even though some of them are resting.
Probably getting about 400 eggs a day.
Every single day. And how long does it take to gather 400 eggs?
It doesn't take that long. We do have to look around for them because the chickens are all running around, and some might put them in different locations. But they lay them mostly in the nesting boxes, which is a nice kind of darkish area. They like the darkish area. So it's not that hard to gather them.
And when you say they run around, are they literally, you think of a big pen, and they run around in there, but do they then get out further and just wander all over the farm?
They do not wander around our farm because we have a lot of coyotes, bobcats, and mountain lions around. So we have a large enclosed area that's even enclosed on the top because of hawks that would come and bother them too. All of our vegetable scraps, we feed them to them. Weeds, we throw them in the pen, and they get stuff like that. So they get a good balanced diet of other stuff.
Do you have to feed them chicken food as well?
We do feed them a little bit of chicken feed, but our main source of feed for them is spent grain from the microbreweries, which is malt, barley, rice, or oats. And they take the wort off to make the beer, and then they throw away the leftover stuff, which is just like oatmeal. And that's what we feed our chickens. That's our main source of feed. And it helps them out a lot by, getting rid of a waste product of theirs. And it helps us out a lot by saving us our feed bill. And it's a good, clean, nutritious source of protein from the microbreweries.
Okay. And because you also like to think of them eating, bugs and stuff. But I guess the pen might be pretty well picked over.
Yeah, the pen is pretty well picked over. But, we do have flies. And then they, eat the flies. They get a good balanced mix.
Do some of the chickens wind up laying eggs that hatch?
We do have some roosters that we keep in some pens because we do incubate a lot of our eggs, all of our turkeys and pheasants and quail. We incubate all those eggs. And so we do even incubate some chicken eggs to keep our flock replenished.
How long I know you get those cute little fuzzy little chicks. How long before they can actually lay an egg?
About 8 to 10 months. Then they'll start laying an 8 to 10 months old.
Peter, you have a large family. How many kids are actually involved in the farm now?
I have two kids still at home, so they're definitely involved in the farm. I have one that graduated, and he came back to be involved in the farm. And I have a daughter that's going to graduate this year, and she plans to come back and be involved in the farm.
Oh, that's great. So you're going to pass on all your knowledge to them, and then
they already have all my knowledge. I'm going to just hopefully pass on all the work.
That would be ideal. All right, Peter. Well, thank you so much. I'm so glad the kids are going to be. The farm's going to stay. You're going to keep providing these wonderful products here to your loyal fans here at the Farmers Market. Thanks so much.
Great. Thank you very much.
That was Peter Shaner. He's a second-generation farmer from North San Diego County now, grew up in Orange County from a farming family, and apparently he's got four of his own kids who are going to be taking over the farm for the next generation or two to come. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
That's it for this week's show. If you've got a favorite breakfast food we missed, share it with us on Instagram or Twitter. Search for @KCRWGoodFood. I happen to fancy a slice of pie for breakfast, and I want to thank the hundreds of bakers, judges, and lovers of pie who turned out for our annual contest last weekend. We've got a list of the winners up on our blog. Check it out. As always, so many thanks to the Good Food team.
Abby Fentress Swanson.
Laryl Garcia.
Joseph Stone.
Hey, Abby, here's mine. Camellia Say.
Joel Stein.
Jackie Luke.
And Ronnie Mickelson.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll be back next week with more Good Food.